Yeah, hello podcast listeners. Thanks for joining us for another week early in the season. We're fired up. We're loving it. The return of the A-League. And we've got a very big show planned for you today with a special guest, Daniel Garb, here alongside Simon Hill, as per usual. Hi, Simon.
Good to see you, Garby. How are you?
Yeah, going very well. Very happy. We got this man in the studio making his, I think it's his podcast debut. Certainly his first appearance for the season. We hope to have him on a bit more. And that is Ante Kovic, former Socceroos goalkeeper, former Wanderers Asian Champions League winner, of course. Hello, Ante.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you, Ante. Thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in, mate. How's life?
It's good. It's good. Life after football, it's starting to get there.
You're busy, huh?
I'm busy. So, got my own personal stuff, renovating a home, which takes a lot of your time, and your life around you doesn't exist when you're renovating. But, other than that, coaching at Marconi, got another little gig on the side with Blacktown Council, and, kids growing up healthy and happy and can't complain too much at the moment.
So. Still looking fit as well.
Yeah, I'm keeping there. I'm a bit lucky that way. I'm not the healthiest person, but seem to be keeping the weight down, which is good.
What is it with former players these days all looking fit? I saw Mark Bresciano at the Australia-Nepal game, Nepal. He could have played 90 minutes. He's been retired for nearly 10 years. What happened to the day when you got retired? You're on the beers and the pies and you just enjoyed yourself. Now they're all looking maybe 2 kilos over playing weight.
I offer you Exhibit A, Alan Brazil.
Yeah, but that's from the old school era.
Yeah.
The current day player, why do you stay in such good nick?
I don't know.
Habit?
Maybe a bit of habit and, there's more going around, I suppose, these days. I think maybe back in the day you sort of retired and you're still hanging out at the pub with your mates and I don't think that happens as much.
Do you still go to the gym?
No, I hate the gym. I've always hated the gym. I hate a gym session. So my wife tries to get me to go to the gym just to inspire her. I go, I've had 20 years of that.
Is it because the current day player gets in such a good routine over eating and things like that, that it's almost harder to break out of that once you finish?
I agree with that. I think back in the early days, you're sort of not enticed, but that was part of culture, wasn't it? Sort of enjoy yourself as well and go drink with the boys. Where these days, everything's scrutinised. Yeah? Your meals and your program week in, week out, away games, your diet's looked after and you sort of just fall into that routine, I think, a little bit.
So you said that you're busy with Blacktown Council, you're renovating your house, you're doing a bit of coaching at Marconi Stallions. So when you finished with the professional game, you didn't have this infamous drop-off, the mental drop of no longer being a professional footballer, because you played until you're in your 40s. So, that must have been a big change in your life.
I was massive, and a lot of players go through, and a lot of my mates that I played with, someone like a Michael Beecham, who I keep in contact with, it is a struggle. You're so, used to a routine, and for me, fortunate enough to have 20 years in the game. And so when you hang it up, it's kind of, you get lost a little bit. Your time goes all over the place and you don't have that structure anymore. So for the first year and a half, definitely I was struggling, thinking, what do? Where do I go? I want to get my coaching badges because that's where I want to go. But then you sort of, things change around a little bit and it's not that easy to get on your feet. And I understand a lot of players really struggle for a long period of time. I'm fortunate enough to sort of find my feet a little bit. Am I quite there where I want to be? Maybe not. But I'm content. I'm happy where I am. I'm still involved with football, coaching at Marconi. I enjoy that a lot. So it's still a great club. It's where I started my football career. So it's sort of like full circle come around for me.
Do footballers get help or do they literally, you drop off the radar as soon as you retire from the professional game? Is that it? Does the wall come down and you're sort of on your own? Or, do your old clubs stay in touch and go, look, we'd want to keep you involved and are you okay? The PFA, all that sort of stuff?
You do fall off a little bit. You are easily forgotten. The PFA does try and help former players, but it sort of gets to a point where it's more if you reach out, they are there to help. Where you don't necessarily get reaching out to you. It's all aware and all that. And I do actually think that former clubs could probably do a little bit more in keeping you in the loop. Because I know for me, even going to games after I retired, it's kind of like almost getting into a bit of a depression. You're going out there and you see the players walk out the field and you've done that for 20 years and you want to get back out there. And it was almost hard to watch, to be at a stadium watching a professional game because you wanted to be out there. And it's been my life for 20 years, like I said. So to actually sit there back and go, and every football club has a go. I've still got it. I could still be out there without question.
Hey, so, journalists too, aren't they?
We still got it as well. Yeah, so
we just never had it.
Yeah, so it's it can be a struggle for some more than others. But yeah, it does take some time to really work out what you can achieve or what you can do. Do you stay in the game? Do you not? Do you go somewhere completely off centre? And then you have those doubts as well, because I retired at 43. So, again, at 43, I've missed a big chunk of, if I want to start a new career, at 43, I haven't retired at 30. It's 43. Mm. Like, what do I start fresh at? You know, you kind of feel like, I don't want to be an apprentice somewhere and start all over again. So, yeah, to find your feet, it's difficult, and you end up in a bit of a lull. So it is tough.
It's the other side of the glamour life of being a professional sports person. But we'll speak a bit about the glamorous moments later on and talk about your career. We're looking forward to that. Apologies to people listening. We didn't ask for Twitter questions this week. Our mistake. We'll make up for it next week. But hopefully we ask Ante enough questions to satisfy your curiosities on his wonderful career. We will talk about the A-League, though, and Ante's been keeping an eye across it all, especially his old club, the Wanderers, and his other old clubs, the Glory and the Victory.
Yeah,
and the Wellington Phoenix for 5 minutes last season.
Yes. I can put that on my resume as well.
So we'll go through all of it. But what caught your eye from the weekend, Simon? What did you take note of?
Just generally, I thought the standard of football was very good. I think it has been over the first couple of rounds. Very intense games. Maybe the weather helps a little bit. It's, you know, not really that hot summer weather yet, which I think helps the tempo of the games, helps the players maintain their intensity for 90 minutes. Ante will probably be able to tell us more on that. I also think, and I'm sure this is a topic we'll get into a bit later, you know, the playing in the right size stadiums, it helps. Certainly thought that with the Sydney Wellington game. You get more of a crowd, the weather's right, the pitch is good. All of a sudden, the conditions for players are all there to perform. And we get games that are commensurate with that. So I've enjoyed watching the A-League over the first couple of rounds. I think the standard's been very, very good.
I agree.
And I think the crowds have responded to that.
Yeah, they have, definitely. And adding on that, no one's really been whitewashed.
No.
You know, you sort of look at it and you go to the Central Coast, okay, Wellington, you know, are they going to struggle this year? But they've all been in it. There hasn't been one game where someone's dominated. Even the Melbourne City-Adelaide game, you look at a 2-0 up and you go, okay, should be okay. But once that goal got back in, they were right back in it. Same with Wellington. Sydney, you know, probably with the aura that they've had, the experience that they have, they've been able to grind out that 2-1 result. But, hey, if Wellington walked away with a draw yesterday, you would have said, hey, well done. You deserve that.
Not at all. Yeah, exactly right. And the Wellington fans, I've got to level things up with them later on in the podcast. We had a bit of a constructive discussion on social media during the week. Some people across the ditch. We'll get onto that a bit later on. We'll get onto that a bit later on, so stay tuned for that. But what caught your eye, aren't they?
Mine's more of a general, obviously. Being a former Wanderer and having them in, close to my heart, they've had a tough few years, and I think they've been really lacking in the front third, and they haven't had cohesion. And I was at the first game against the Central Coast, and I thought they were lucky to get away with a win. Mm. Central Coast dominated them in the first half, and I thought, oh, here we go. Are we back at the same old Wanderers of last year? Are they going to struggle against when they get up to oppositions like the Sydney FCs, the Melbourne Victories? And then they pull out a performance like that against Victory in Melbourne, and they absolutely dominated the game, front and back. And the other aspect of it is Meyer, who I thought I was critical of in the first game. I thought he was underdone. But now you saw a little bit of class and what someone like him can do. Mm. And if he gets to full fitness and continues on that, Wanderers can be really a strong force going forward into season. And it sets up the derby. Beautiful.
Oh, yeah. It's set up a mammoth occasion on Saturday night, which we'll speak to you about as well, just what those games are like when they are top level, like we'll have on the weekend. For me, what caught my eye? Angry Aussies. What's Aaron Mooy doing getting 2 yellow cards 5 minutes either side of each other? The second one, which was blatant after he's just been booked. So unlike him, after he's just worked his way into the Brighton side, big setback for him. And Jackson Irvine as well had a little moment with the supporter in Hull's loss to QPR where he turned around and gave it to a fan. And I thought to myself, is it something off a couple of or two or three long plane trips during the international break I said to the Aussies coming back just a little bit cranky. Can it take its toll, that sort of stuff?
Oh, look, it can take its toll.
You wouldn't think so, I'm in business class.
You know, it's probably a little bit different. You don't see it too often that you sort of travel and you're cranky. You're sort of a little bit tired and you get home and you're exhausted and you just want to put out a good performance. But, yeah, it's a little bit unusual, especially for someone like Aaron Mooy.
Do you ever have a crack at a fan, Ante?
No, I gave stick to fans because I copped a lot of stick over 20 years. So,
Who were the worst?
For me, I kind of enjoyed it. Adelaide United,
right.
Because of the stadium so compact and the fans are literally on top of you. And I copped a hell of a lot at that ground constantly. So if ever we were in the lead or looking at a victory, that was one ground I'd love to turn around and just give it back to them because that will fire them up even more. But
is there ever a time? I mean, a lot of it is just abusive, I would imagine, particularly as an opposition goalkeeper.
Yes.
Is there ever a time where a fan comes out with something witty that makes you giggle, even though it's in the white hot battle of a game?
Yeah, there is, and it's usually a stupid comment that you have to laugh at to come up with one off the top of my head. I don't know, but you do have a giggle occasionally. Yeah, like you said, 99% of it is just absolute abuse at you, and you just. You have to take it. That's part and parcel of the game, and you learn to put up with it. But occasionally, someone comes up with something silly or worth a bit of a chuckle, and you know it's a bit of banter. So,
How would you have responded? Sorry to interrupt, Garby. You know when Vedran Janjetovic came out, he played his first time against Sydney FC, and the snakes were being thrown on top of the goal, which was journalistic gold for us.
Yeah.
But as a goalkeeper, do you sometimes have to try and block? You've got to be pretty strong mentally,
haven't you, to
block that out.
I'm telling you,
get to you.
Yeah, goalkeepers. I'm telling you, goalkeepers is one position you have to be mentally strong. You're not in the game too much, and you have to be focused on that. But you're in an area, usually away fans, where you're copping it nonstop, and something like that. You're changing a side, like that's a derby, Sydney FC Wanderers, and you're changing teams and snakes. And it plays on your mind, but you've got to try and just block it out as well as you can. And sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes you get rolled into it, and you do something stupid because of it. So if you're not mentally capable of just stuff it, I'm doing what I have to do, and they can say what they want, you have to be strong to be able to like resist the urge to turn around and give them something back. But that's what they're trying to do, aren't they? They're trying to upset the goalkeeper and make you make a mistake. So you've got to learn from experience to not bite into that.
Funny you mention that because that can be the case in social media as well. Not biting into it, not being drawn into. Little fracas like
I'm
that.
Learning.
But Simon Ante has chosen to re-enter that world after staying out of it
God help
for
us.
So
That's
long.
That's why I kept out of social media for my whole career.
So did I for 10 years.
I couldn't bite my lip.
We let it lie last week, but you are back on Twitter, Simon Hill 1894. What has prompted...
That's not the year of my birth, by the way. It's the year of Manchester City's birth, in case anybody's wondering.
What has prompted this re-emergence into the crazy world of soccer Twitter, as we call it in Australia?
I just think that the game at the moment... is suffering from a lack of debate. And I felt it was time that maybe I played my part a little bit more. It's not always easy to have conversations about the issues surrounding the game, and I think it's important. People, disagree with a lot of what I say, that's fine. I don't have an issue with that, as long as people aren't abusive. I'm not bothered about that. But I think it's... Look, I'm not a fan of Twitter in general, to be honest. I do think it's a whole lot of white noise. But I think and my first week's experience has actually been pretty good. People have not only been fairly respectful, but they've contributed good arguments in some of the debates that I've had, particularly around VAR. And I know people are passionate about it. People know my views on that. But I equally respect that a lot of people like it and think it's a good... introduction for the game. That's okay. I respectfully disagree. So I think it's good to have these conversations. There is too much in this country. We can't say that. We can't have that debate. Sit down, shut up, do as you're told, get what you're given, and just get on with it. Well, all that breeds is a sanitized game that is bland. And when you have a bland game, people switch off. They disengage. This debate is good. So long as it's respectful and not abusive, debate is good for the game. We have to discuss these issues. the more conversations we have around football, I don't know whether you agree, Ante, the bigger hopefully the game gets, because people become engaged in those discussions and they become passionate about it and therefore the game. I think that's healthy. Why are we trying to stop it?
Yeah.
But so that's the reason.
It's an epidemic, isn't it? Like in general, like keep your mouth shut. You don't want to controversy or upset someone. And that's the whole aspect of debating, isn't it? You get upset somebody.
Yeah.
Is there a fine line sometimes between only debating the negative issues and not talking up the game, but focusing on the positive stuff? Do we sometimes get caught down that landmine in Australian football?
Well, I mean, that's for other people to decide. I think, you know, during the week is the time to debate all that stuff, good and bad. And I don't just focus on the negatives.
I'm not saying you do. I'm saying in terms of the discussions in Australian football, so some people will say it's all people just pick on the negatives all the time. They only complain. There's no perspective. They don't look at the positives of the game. Well, in terms of the debate around Australian football.
Garby, you know, let's be honest. If we're being brutally honest, over the last 3 years, there's been a lot of issues. So we have to resolve those, or we have to debate them at the very least.
I don't disagree.
Yes, of course there are positives, and we do talk about them. We talk about them a lot. But what I don't like is this insistence that, you have to talk about the positives. Ignore the negatives. We have to focus on the positives. It's got to be a mixture of both. And let's have the conversation about all of it. And that's healthy for the game. Without it, we have a game that basically has no conversation and therefore zero interest. That's my view anyway.
For sure. And Twitter can bring about a lot of constructive discussion, which I found out during the week. Now, I said on the podcast last week.
Okay, go on.
On Wellington, when you asked me, am I worried about them? And I said, right. Yes, I am. This was before they signed Gary Cooper.
I think we've all tipped them for the bottom.
Yeah, so I'm not on my own there. But I did say, I think we'll be talking about the same things with the Wellington that we have done prior to last season when they had a very good campaign, of which Ante was involved with for one afternoon in Sydney.
Yes.
But
that changed their whole season.
And I wasn't talking about their future and their longevity in the league. That wasn't in my mind at all. I was talking about the discussion around Wellington's validity in the league and the contribution to the league. Are they dragging it down? Are they adding to it? A discussion we've had over a long period of time. And yes, some fans across the ditch got very sensitive, and I can understand why, and defensive, because they've copped it for so many years and they've had enough of it. And the season's just started and here I am, you know, predicting another doom and gloom campaign for them. So I'm just trying to explain where I was coming from on that. And they have been pretty good since I have explained it. The Gary Hooper signing does change things a lot though, because that is a big statement. That's a player with, you know, great pedigree. You put in that 11 and you think, wow, if they can get some good service around him, he can score a lot of goals, assuming his fitness is up to scratch, which I imagine Wellington have done their due diligence on. So I'm sure he is. The signs are very good yesterday. I still worry over the course of the season, though, whether they'll have enough quality to give him enough service to be a team that it is outside the bottom three.
Garby, you're entitled to your opinion, though.
Wellington fans
are entitled to theirs
sure.
as well. And that's fine. That's good to have that debate. The question I wanted to ask Ante on this, just to pick up on the back end of that discussion was, you know, do the players get involved in all this enough? Because it's your livelihoods, not you anymore, but, you know, the players, I think, need to have more public discussions and opinions as well. I think too often the clubs dampen down what players say, and we need that. Yeah. I remember the early years of the A-League, Miron Blyberg and John Cosmina going at it in public.
Yeah.
John Cosmina and Kevin Muscat with their infamous set two. We had some real characters in the league, and they created great talking points and interest for the supporters. I think the players should be encouraged to get more involved in this.
I think they should, and you know there is discussion. In the playing group, there's always discussion about the league, because we all wanted the game to grow and get bigger and more exciting and get the fans in there. But I think we're in an age right now where you're really wary of what you say, because there's consequences on something that can be, in your opinion, so minor that you're almost now pushed in a box to not say anything, because I don't want to lose my spot, or I don't want to offend someone because they're going to come back to me, where, you know, probably a few years ago, you could say a few things and you go, hey, you know what? It's a professional game. Take it, you know, be strong about it.
In terms of the general discussion in the league, I think Australian footballers are more involved than any other code. They're really invested in the actual future of the competition and want it to thrive. Players do get sensitive when you criticise them, though, when you talk about their individual team or their individual performance.
Yeah. But I think that's where we have to toughen up. And you said it. Talking about the negatives. And you know what? Unfortunately, that's what life is. At training, if I have a bad game, what are we going to talk about? My performance. How am I going to improve? By looking at where I stuffed up.
But players read all that, don't they? They read what pundits say. They read what.
But you know what? You've got to be man enough to go, okay, if I've had a poor game, let's not focus on the one little pass that I did great, because there's a lot you can improve on. If we just focus on that, you're missing the whole picture. And as a league, as a team, how are you going to improve if you don't have those hard discussions?
Absolutely.
In a team environment and in a football environment.
You look at the most popular commercially, I'm not saying it's the best league in the world, but a lot of people think it is, the English Premier League. That thrives on this conversation that is, goes round, or the news cycle, Monday, Tuesday, where it's all, discussion about, is this player worth his spot? Is that coach going to get sacked? What this player said, what he did off the field. But the minutiae of the game is discussed in such great detail in all these countries in the world. And we just don't have that to any great degree. And when we try to have it, a lot of people get shut down. No, you can't talk about that. Mm. Well, why not? That's how we grow the game, is growing the interest.
On the Phoenix, though, look, going back to that point, we'll move on to the game with Sydney from the weekend. I think a good Phoenix is really good for the league. I think we've got an asset there in which we've got a whole country that has a very good football culture.
Oh, you're backtracking well here, Garvey. Yeah.
No, I'm just I'm clarifying my statement for those fans who were very
unhappy.
You know
what? If the league is doing well and we get that right and those discussions that we're talking about, then Wellington Phoenix, they have their place in the league.
Of course they do.
The only discussions here is because the league's, the last few years hasn't been going great, and let's throw Wellington under the bus. And you're going, well, let's get the league right.
My underlying theme to my comment was Wellington can make a huge difference to the league, because they should have a whole country to draw upon.
Yes.
To contribute to our footballing landscape as well. And we give them that landscape to develop young New Zealand players, of which they are doing arguably per capita better than Australia right now when you look at some of the talents coming through. And we get a thrill out of that as well. We love watching Sarpreet Singh last season. We love watching Liberato Kakache. We love watching young Kiwi talents
maybe
coming
not his
through.
Challenge on Sunday, but yes,
not his challenge. We love watching Marco Rojas. They might not be Aussies, but we get a joy out of it because they are part of our league and they've come through our league, and that's good for Australian football. So I'm on board with the Phoenix. There's no agenda there. I just worry if the Phoenix is struggling, and there's only 5,000 in that big stadium, it is not good for the league. It really does drag the league down.
Not.
And that was my concern prior to the Gary Hooper signing, which has changed that.
Look, it's not a good look for the league. Equally, I had a discussion with somebody on Twitter this week who said to me that the Mariners should be dispatched and, a fourth team brought in from Northern Sydney. Now, to me, that's counterproductive. You can't spend 15 years, or in the case of Wellington Phoenix, 11 years, building up a club, building up a brand, building up an image, however small and, unstable that may be. We, at the moment, are putting in place the building blocks for the next generation. That's our job. Mm. The A-League in 40, 50, 60 years' time, hopefully it's still around and thriving, these clubs will be then well embedded in the landscape. They already are to a large degree. You don't just rip things up and start again. We've done that too many times. But that seems to be the default position of a lot of people here. Oh, they're not doing well. Get rid of them. Rip them up and start again somewhere else. That's not the answer. We need to build that history, longevity, and that generational support that will only come in 20, 30, 40 years' time. We're not going to be around to see it, unfortunately, but that's our job at the moment, I think, as football people in this country.
Yeah, agree.
Most certainly. The Phoenix looked good yesterday, really good against Sydney FC. It took a Ryan Grant magical flick to give Sydney the win. He's just oozing confidence right now,
he's
isn't he?
Brilliant.
Every game he plays in, he seems to excel.
And that's the thing. I don't think he's doing anything extraordinary, but every single game he's doing the right things, the right movements, up there for support, backtracking, going. He's just Mr. Consistent, doing things right week in, week out. He's
a man,
one of the form players without question.
A man with a bogan mullet shouldn't have a touch of the delicate.
And that's what's great about him. He doesn't bring all that attention on him besides his bloody mullets and his Corona.
He's
his own character, but he just plays his football and he does his job.
I'll tell you what amazes me about Ryan Grant. He plays 180 minutes in two internationals, plus all the travels. He puts on three assists. And then against Wellington Phoenix, he was up and down that line. He's a machine.
Yes.
In terms of his fitness. No, forget his goal, which was very good. My question for Ante, and I asked this during commentary on Sunday afternoon, we love him in the A-League, but why has he not been snapped up by an overseas club?
Mm.
Yeah, is it visa issues? I mean, he's certainly playing enough Socceroos, is it the mullet?
I don't know. That's a definite talking point. That is a player on form that warrants an opportunity at a bigger league.
Yeah.
He does. The way he's performing right now, he warrants an opportunity. But why it's not – is it him? Is he happy to be home?
Maybe he doesn't want to go.
Is he that casual Aussie bloke that loves being at home and playing in front of your home fans and your club that you've been since day one? Is that his drive?
Well, you look at his Toyota Corona, he's hardly aching for a fancy footballer's car, is he? So maybe he is that kind of guy. And look, I imagine he's on a very good deal at Sydney FC now because he's proven himself regular with the Socceroos. The match payments there, as we know, so it's not like he's way below the line of a well-earning professional.
And sometimes, how many footballers have we said that they go overseas and they don't find their niche? Mm. They're a little bit lost. Maybe he's in his comfort zone.
And the great thing about that is because he's now been at Sydney FC for 10 years, you saw that the TIFO that the Cove put up pre-game yesterday, and he was included as one of the legends along with all the championship-winning captains and everything else. So, you know, that is a rarity in modern football, isn't it? Yeah. You stay with a club for 10 years. You certainly didn't, Ante. And he's therefore become a club legend, and we're building that over time. In 50 years' time, people will look back and go, "Oh, I remember Ryan Grant. He was this guy who's playing now is not a patch on Ryan Grant." That's what we're building.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. And you know what? That TIFO was great. I think for Sydney, like, to respect players that have done. I think we should be doing more of that. League-wide.
It was wonderful. The Phoenix were great value too. They deserve something,
they were terrific,
arguably,
yes,
from the game. So good signs for them. And now they bring Gary Hooper back into the team for a home clash against – they play Perth next week, I think they do.
They do play Perth.
So that's big for them.
It is. And just – sorry, one more on Sydney. Given that we've eulogised over Ryan Grant, rightly so. But I thought – I mean, we just alluded to it. They were damn lucky to get away with that win. Wellington Phoenix really took it to them second half. And I thought some of the football that Ufuk Tale's team played yesterday was absolutely terrific. Yeah. I thought David Ball worked tirelessly. Looking forward to seeing him in partnership with Gary Hooper if he goes with the two up top, which I think he probably will do. And Roofer and Steinman, aside of that first 15 minutes, they absolutely took control of that midfield.
Mm. They were good. It sets up that Sydney win, though. Mouth-watering
Sydney Derby
on Saturday night. I mean, just massive. Bankwest Stadium should have over 30,000 there because the Wanderers got the job done over the victory on Friday night. The victory are a secondary discussion point in terms of where they are right now, but if you were back playing for Western Sydney on a Monday leading into a derby like this, what would be going through your mind and through your body?
It's set up perfectly because, firstly, both teams, two wins on the trot, and on the Wanderers side, you've hit some form and you've got some good players in there and you're playing good football. And I know it's been tough to be a Wanderer in the derbies. You know, Sydney have had the upper hand. You know, Western Sydney Wanderers, they did knock them off in that 1-0 win. I think they, you know, surprised Sydney FC. They didn't lose a game all season.
A couple of years ago, Santa got the winner.
So they've had a little bit of taste. And derbies are a completely different game, and you know, I've mentioned to a lot of people that you approach every game the same, but there's something about derbies that just set it all up, and yeah, you know, it's the cliche, the form book goes out the window, doesn't it?
Mm.
But both teams
are in form.
Wanderers, and different type of form. That Wanderers have had a tough last few years, and they've started to hit a bit of form, and they've seen a bit of structure. Babel's had a more of a run into the pre-season and got the team that he wants. Sydney's got the aura of having three fantastic years, 3-4 being the top team, the one that everyone feared, the team that can grind something out every single game. But the Wanderers now are in a different trajectory. They've picked up this year, and I think they're looking good. If they can keep this form, it's going to be a cracker of a game. And what a stadium to have it at.
Have you got a special derby memory? You played in a few. I think you played in a Melbourne derby as well.
Yeah, played
at F3. You played in a few F3 derbies.
Yeah,
I don't know if you played in any in Sweden.
Played in quite a few in Sweden. Yeah. So there's three Stockholm
what
teams.
What was the Hammarby derby?
The Hammer Beer was against AIK, okay. Against Your Garden. So there's three Stockholm teams and three big teams, and there's a massive rivalry there. And the first derby that I had with AIK, Mr. Luke Cassidy was playing for AIK at the
right?
time as well. So
another former Marconi player.
Yes, yes. So their derbies are huge. Like when I was there, the stadiums were filled out every single time, 30,000 people, and the TIFO and the support was pretty phenomenal. So it was. I've been blessed in terms of playing in derbies, and the Sydney Derby is an absolute cracker. Which one stands out for me? Geez. You know, you probably even go back just to the first one, that whole hype, East against West, yeah. and Del Piero, you know, is at Sydney FC and saved his penalty. So
you did but, too.
But he scored on the rebound. So, but I can still claim that I saved Del Piero's penalty. So
brilliant.
Yeah, look, those first few years in the Sydney derby, we had the upper hand on Sydney. So we had the wood on them. Every derby for me is special because... But having said that, I had a good run in those Sydney derbies. The Wanderers were the dominant force.
I'm trying to remember, did you play in the one where Kerem Bullitt scored a couple of goals, or had you left by then? Because that's the one that I remember being, in terms of atmosphere, just incredible. Hairs on the back of my neck was standing on end, and you thought, geez, I'm in Europe here.
Yeah. This,
you know, three quarters was red and black, and then obviously the sky blue of Sydney in one, you know, block in the corner. And you could barely hear yourself think. I'm just trying to remember whether you played in that or whether you'd
left. I would have played because I was there the whole time. Yeah. He came back with a second stint. Was that the second stint that he came?
I can't remember. Anyway, they were great memories.
It was, you know, coming from Europe and seeing some of the derbies over there, like it was probably the first time that I've come back to Australia and gone, wow, this is bloody impressive. If we can really take off from here, that atmosphere.
The atmosphere on Saturday night will be as good as a European game.
Yeah.
Like there's no, you know, no bones about it. It will be as good as a European football game.
And it's a stadium that's going to entice
that sort of support.
It's a fantastic stadium. It's the seating's so raked. Everyone's on top of each other. That noise is going to echo around that stadium.
So you'll be there on Saturday?
I'm going to definitely try and get out there. I'm looking at got a friend's birthday, but it might have to wait a little bit. I'm going to rock up.
Do you wear your red and black scarf and do you, you know, get up and... Do Who Do We Sing For and all that stuff? Or are you a little bit more reserved?
I'm a little bit more reserved.
He's in the prawn sandwich brigade, Fox.
Respect the club and everything. And, you know, I'm there. My heart's always going to be with the Wanderers and I want them to win. But, a little bit more reserved in that respect. I'm always going to, you know, have a soft spot for them.
You played for the Victory as well. And Newcastle, we left out earlier on in the podcast when we mentioned all your clubs. Are you worried about Melbourne Victory? Two games in?
I don't know whether I'm worried because I still think they've got a lot of quality, and the big question mark for me is that they've lost an awful lot of creativity during the off season. You know, James Troisi's gone, Keisuke Honda has gone,
Terry
Antonis has gone. They've lost Costa Barbarousis has gone. So that, you know, that's four big players. Toivonen's still there. Robbie Cruz obviously hasn't featured yet. He'll add a lot, I think, when he's finally fit. Andrew Nabut has not quite hit his straps.
Nor has Jakob Poulsen yet.
Neither has Jakob Poulsen. Sometimes it takes a while for, you know, foreign players to settle in. I think they'll be okay. I still think they'll quite comfortably make the finals, but certainly they've not had a great start.
I think that's where Wanderers dominated Victory in the midfield. Like you said, they've lost a lot of creativity, and I think they were a little bit disjointed in that middle. That link from the back to the front, it just wasn't fluid that we've seen in the last few years of Victory. So if they can get that working and up to shape, they're a big club. There's a lot of expectation on them. They've got a coach that's, you know, he's got background now. He did well with Adelaide. I don't think they'll be in trouble, but there's a couple of little question marks around exactly where are they going to go this year.
You know the other guy they miss? And he's one of those unsung heroes. He's like the Cloud Makélélé. I'm not saying he was that level with respect to him, Carl Valeri. Yeah. But he was the guy who just sat and, you know, made sure that their shape was right and broke up opposition attacks and just gave them that solidity to a large degree in the heart of midfield. Now, I'm sure Poulsen will give them that as well at some stage, but maybe he's not.
And he was a leader. He was the leader for Victory. And you know, sometimes... You need that leadership above a phenomenal player. And Carl Valeri was a great player, but he had that leadership, that had that respect. in the whole squad.
Western United have leadership. They've got quality as well. A 1-1 draw in their first home game. But some of the football they're playing is really enjoyable to watch. Kone, Diamanti especially. Wow. Yeah. I mean, we're enjoying him at the moment and he doesn't seem like he's lost much, but it's scary to think what he would have done 3 years ago when the Victory tried to get him and that deal fell through, because I think he's been the best player across the league in the
first
4 weeks.
Well, I played against him when we won the Champions League when he was playing for Guangzhou, and he was quality in that midfield. Like, I'm still surprised that we got through that game, but we did. But yeah, he was phenomenal, and yeah, you can't replace class. You just hope that he can stay fit and be able to, once the temperatures get warmer, is he going to struggle a little bit? That's the question mark. But in terms of class, like, geez, he's got a pedigree that's unbelievable.
I think in general, you know, you look at the Kone, Diamante, Scott McDonald, Bessart, Berisha. You know, if those four stay fit and in form, Western United are going to have a good season. Yeah. But they're all the wrong side of 30. You're right, the ground gets, you know, hard. They're already hard, but the sun starts to bake it and you've got all the travel, different conditions, whether they're going to stay fit for the duration. But I think overall, Western United's squad is good enough to be top six.
They've still got Sebastian Pasquale and Apostolos Stamatolopoulos to bring back in. I mean, they've got young reinforcements.
Garby.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was, actually.
They've got young reinforcements to introduce.
Yes, they have.
Of quality, who have shown they can mix it in the A-League already. The crowd was decent, I thought. Oh, you know, it's not what we want. But for a team that's just started, you looked at the membership figures early on, I know it's their first home game, I thought it was a decent aesthetic spectacle.
Yeah, look, it's okay. Obviously, it doesn't look the best because of the size of the stadium and because of the layout of the stadium.
Yes.
If that game had been played at Leichhardt Oval, it would have looked a lot better, but obviously it wasn't. I think it was a little bit below par. I'm not trying to be too unkind to them, but you look at previous expansion clubs, Gold Coast, their first home game had 7,526. North Queensland Fury, 8,897. Wellington had nearly 15,000 their first game, and the Wanderers had 10,500. So I think they've got a bit of work to do in that regard. It'll be interesting to see how many turn up this coming Sunday, because it's their first derby against Melbourne City. So you'd hope that they would crack five figures for that with the travelling support. And I also know they've got a new CEO, Chris Pelavanis, who is apparently very highly rated. And I think he's been given the task to, right, okay, you've got to drive these crowds up. Because these first 3 years are going to be tricky. They know that.
Well, there's parallels with, our first year at the Wanderers.
Yeah.
We didn't set the world on fire in the first couple of games in terms of support. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had the 7,000-8,000 in the first couple of games. But I think Rudan's done extremely well. He's got a lot of experience.
Yeah, his team's fine.
But he's been smart in it. Sometimes with a situation like this, I think experience is what you really need. And you've got some names in there that people can really latch onto, like we just mentioned, Diamante, McDonald, Berisha's back. So you've got a squad there that you can really associate with in terms of quality of players. And now it's going to really drive, like it did with the Wanderers. If they get on a bit of a run, get some wins, that creates the interest. And that creates a... And if they can build... it'd be hard to match what the Wanderers did. But, we really built from something that was pretty good to start with, the victories and the run that we took really brought them in, and it just sort of then it starts holding on. So that's their challenge right now, to keep that momentum going.
Hey, when you were running around at the Wanderers, did you come across Tony Popovich's sons?
I remember Popovich's sons back in the Socceroos days when we used to travel around and they'll
knee high to a grasshopper,
and all that.
Can you believe they're scoring in the A-League now?
That's pretty good. That's got to be a proud moment, And there's always going to be criticism. The whole your son, he gets a free ride coming in, but I know Popovich is a smart man. He's not going to push his sons if they're not capable. He's not going to put himself in that situation. And that would have been, I could imagine if my son one day, gets to that sort of level and scores a goal, what that would mean. And you could see how proud he was, but he's still a man that holds back, doesn't want to show too much emotion, but that would have been a massive moment for him and his family.
Does your son play, Hanso?
He does play. He's only 11 years old and he's... does everything opposite to me, doesn't support the teams that I support.
Which teams do you support?
The Mighty Reds?
I'm a Liverpool supporter.
Of course you are. Which part of Liverpool are you from? And yeah. I'm not talking the one near Bankstown.
No, I know everyone jumps on a winner. And back in the days when I was growing up, they were a winner. But I still remember the day.
We Craig are genuine, Johnson, aren't they? Don't Craig buy Johnson. Into it. Don't take the bait.
You know, I jumped on it because also we had Craig Johnson there, an Aussie that came into that squad. And that's when they were on fire. And you go, an Aussie's playing for Liverpool. That's amazing. Mm. And it stuck for me. So, but my son's a Man U supporter because they probably
have
the, yeah. So I try and change him here and there, and yeah, you know, I love Barcelona at in Spain, but my son was a Real Madrid supporter because he loves Ronaldo, but now he seems to be just following Ronaldo wherever he goes. So he's an outfield player; he plays up front, so he didn't follow that in his footsteps either. So, but yeah, he loves the game, which makes me very happy.
Craig Johnston, who was at the F3 Derby on Saturday,
yeah, he's involved a lot now, which is great. Yeah, the hook for a lot of, you know, Australian Liverpool fans was Craig Johnston. We only got one game a year on live TV, and he played in a couple of FA Cup finals. So that did the business. Popper, a lot of people have said, you know, cynically, you know, he's pushing his sons. You speak to people at the Glory, they are well and truly up for it, both of them, Gabe and Christian, and they deserve the chance. And now with the new under-23 rule, they get it every week to sit on the bench. So well done. And I'm sure I agree with you, you wouldn't be pushing them unless they were up to the standard. Melbourne City, good win for them yesterday in the lead-up to the FFA Cup final coming up this week. And, geez, Jamie McLaren, his instincts are so sharp right now in a goal-scoring sense, aren't they? His confidence is just,
his stats
at a perfect level.
Are incredible at the moment. He has got, in 8 competitive games so far this season, FFA Cup, A-League, World Cup qualifiers, he scored 12 goals in 8 games, including 8 in his last 4. That's ridiculous. And he's just, he's in that zone at the moment. He just can't miss.
No,
wherever he is, he scores.
It's understated, like confidence is a big thing, but it's understated. When you're high on confidence, it just feels like everything falls into place and he's loving it at the moment. Like you watch him play and he's just expressive on the field. He doesn't doubt himself. He looks like a world-class player at the moment, and it's great to see him like come back to Australia, and he probably had a tough time abroad. Comes back and he's hit the ground running.
Has the emergence of Jamie and the re-emergence of Adam Taggart finally put to bed this argument of who's going to take over from Timmy? Have we finally moved past that?
Not for me, because we've got options now, but we still don't have a guy that we are confident will lead the line at a World Cup. I mean, that's, okay, you can score against Nepal and Chinese Taipei and that's great. The second phase, again, the pressure will go up. But I think what we want is someone that we can set up in our 11s and say, right, that's our striker. And, he might not win the Golden Boot, but we are confident that player is the one that can lead the line and do the job like Viduka did, like Timmy did at a World Cup. We have options now, which is great, because 12 months ago, I don't think we had options that we were confident with. We've now got 3 or 4 players we can... Now, Graham Arnold can shift through with some confidence, but geez, there's still levels to go, aren't there?
Is there still time for Tommy Juric, your old teammate, Anto?
Geez, I don't know, to be honest. With the form of someone like a Taggart and McLaren, it's hard to see him force himself back into contention, really. Mm. If they keep going on their path like they are, I don't see room for him.
He's playing at a big club now, isn't he? CSKA Sofia.
Sofia,
Bulgaria.
Yeah.
Interesting move.
Interesting move, yeah. Well, he wants to stay out there and stay in Europe, and he's getting gigs, so he's doing something right. But at the moment, when someone's in form, you've got to put your hand up and go, geez, I've got to do something special.
His problem is he doesn't necessarily fit Arnie's way of playing. Arnie wants a lot of fluidity. He's been on the record of saying that. Taggart and McLaren are central strikers too, but Tommy's the target man. He wants players who, if Mabil goes central and you go out wide, you're comfortable there.
And you've got pace there, you've got directness, you've got that goal poacher instinct that they do. And Tommy Juric is, like you said, a little bit more of a target man, a little bit more composed and slow when slows the play down. And, he's not really that, get in the box and, hit him and you'll get a goal.
He needs to fight against that.
Yeah, and that's going to be hard.
But goals, and ultimately goals force selection decision. If he starts banging them in, then he'll be looked at, I'm sure. The F3 derby was, I thought, quite entertaining on Saturday night. It was tasty, and it had a bit of pace to it, which was good to watch.
I love that Ante's just sat back in the chair and folded his arms because he knows what's coming.
Oh, I do.
Should we go for the big incident?
We'll talk about the game first.
All right.
Well, you were there.
Yeah, I thought the game was very good. I think that the Mariners have shown that they've got a bit more resilience about them this year. Last year, look, the Jets dominated for large parts of that second half in particular. They really took it to the Mariners. Last year, I reckon the Mariners would have lost that game 3 or 4-1 quite easily. They dug in, and at the end, they almost pinched it. You know, they had a good last 5 or 10 minutes, the Central Coast. I love Milan Djuric.
Mm. Oh, it's
what a clean striker of the ball he is. I think I said during the call on Saturday, he's the cleanest striker of a footballer I've seen in the A-League since Nebojša Marinković. Mm. He really hits it so sweetly and struck the base of the post late on. So I think there's encouragement for the Central Coast. Likewise for Newcastle, I thought Arroyo was not really effective, to be honest. Maybe his time will come. Obviously, they've got a few injuries as well, the Jets, and that was their first hit out. Dimi Petratos was very good, very, very busy. But, of course, the big talking point was the penalty. And yeah. Well, not the award of the penalty, but the retake. And should the retake have been retaken? Ante Kovac, the stage is yours.
No, it shouldn't have been. Plain and simple. It's really starting to frustrate me, these type of decisions, especially for a goalkeeper. For me, a player should be, they've probably got an 80% chance of scoring. That's what you'd expect, at least. The keeper's the one, if you save it, you're a hero, but you're not expected to save it. Now, you know, usually you win a penalty and it's, you know, most of the time they go, okay, it's a handball or whatever. It's not a clear-cut goal-scoring opportunity. So if a keeper's already on the back step, unless it's going to be absolutely blatant where you take two jumps forward and cut the angle and go out, but to get that timing right, he's taken one step forward, okay, the back foot's left and he's dived. Well, what's the problem? Like the players should still be able to finish the job. That's their job. You know, it's a big goal, but yeah, you know, to get that fine line, and you mentioned it earlier about if he has to go to the VAR, the official standing on the byline, if he's not seeing it, why does it have to be stopped by the VAR?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I query that one. We look at how much
because then VAR you're saying then you're saying used. It's touch and go because you're trying to see.
That's not a hard one.
But, yeah, you know, if it's blatant, you'll see it.
To me, VAR's brought in under the premise of, let's help the officials. I don't think the officials need help with that one. There's a linesman standing there. It's not moving quickly.
You don't have to focus on anything
out of the
else.
Corner of his eye when, or from the moment the referee's blown his whistle for the penalty to be taken, he can spot the goalkeeper. He should be flagging for that. I think we need to be just a bit more selective with how we use VAR. The Liverpool-Man United game this morning, you know, there's a lot of talk over the foul that should have been given. But how far back do we go? I'm not a fan of going back.
This is the whole thing. Is it, by you mentioned it, by the rule book? Did he encroach? Should it be taken?
Yeah.
Yes. Is the rule book is black and white. The game is not black and white. So you're talking about opening a whole can of worms because if you go by the rule book on every single challenge, there'll be cards, there'll be fouls all over the place.
Yeah. I know people you got VAR, surely you'd use it for that, but I don't think we want to use it for everything.
No.
We still want the officials to have some sort of ownership over their calls.
This is great. I'm not having to say a word.
So you mentioned the Liverpool, the Manchester United goal. Like, okay, was that a foul? By the book, there was a bit of talent, but I would say that, no, that's not a foul.
I think it was a foul. I think it's a blatant foul. But I don't want the referee going back and chalking off the goal because of a foul
back
in play.
To me, Klopp made a very interesting point afterwards saying that if VAR didn't exist, would he have blown the foul? Are the referees now going, oh, I'm not sure, I'll just let play on.
And then and they can decide.
And they'll decide afterwards. Look, like, that's got to be in the referees.
I'm not saying it's a yellow card, but it's a foul. But I don't want VAR going back and looking at foul because we're getting into a very dangerous situation then. So I have no issue with the goal standing. You know, I'm saying the referee got it wrong. The old-fashioned, the referee got it wrong, and it was an easy call, and he shouldn't make that mistake, just like you blame a striker when he misses an easy chance, or a keeper when he makes an easy mistake, or a coach when he makes an easy selection gaff. You can criticise it. That's part of the game. So for me, criticise the ref, but you don't have to chalk it off. And I just don't think we need to be having VAR looking at the goalkeeper on the line because it's not that difficult of a situation to adjudicate for the linesman.
Well, this has always been my point. Once you introduce VAR for all these incidents, then you're opening up this can of worms,
yeah,
and everything is now going to be scrutinised, as it was on Saturday night, not just with the Birigiti off his line, which forced the retake. And yes, I totally accept that by the letter of the law, that's correct to have the retake. Similarly, with the retake, there were three or four players encroaching into the box, including one Newcastle Jets player. So the retake should have been retaken as well. Now, I checked this with the authorities and they confirmed, yes, it should have been a retake, but they didn't spot it. The VAR apparently doesn't have the authority to intervene in that, but it does with Birigiti off his line. So, you know, fans...
So who makes those decisions?
Exactly. Well, it's IFAB.
Who says it's this one's good enough, but that one's not good enough?
Exactly. So this is the problem with it. If you're introducing it and we're having it for all these incidents, it has to be for everything. And therefore, you're going to have a game that's going to be stop-start. I think the fans don't know when to cheer. The players don't know when to celebrate. Anyway.
It was a good F3 derby, yes, either way. The Jets have Adelaide at home next week, so a chance to register a win. Central Coast, who have started the season really brightly, have the bye. Alan Stadjic doing some good things there. Hey, Mark Viduka made a rare appearance over the weekend.
Oh, I did. I missed that.
He for Leeds' 100-year anniversary.
Ah.
Sightings of the V-bomber are like a lunar eclipse. I mean, you've got to go outside and make sure you see it.
There's one man who left the game
on speed dial
and just left the game, didn't he? That's the...
Yeah. No, it's like you should be sitting on your front porch waiting to see it all happen when the V-bomber comes out of nowhere and says something. And he spoke really beautifully about his time at Leeds and what it meant to him and the Liverpool game, which even Australian Liverpool fans enjoyed because an Aussie had such a big impact. What was your relationship like with Mark Viduka when you played?
Oh, he is one of the absolute legends of the game. The easiest bloke to be alongside in a team environment, in a personal environment. He was just so easy to approach and talk to, and half the time nothing was serious with him.
Yeah.
and the jokes that he'd come out were so stupid that you had to laugh because of the stupidity. But he was just a genuine guy, but when the job was there to be done, he was straight on that front foot. And for me, when I rocked up in the Socceroos, like, that for me was daunting. 31 years of age playing in Sweden, and you've got the golden generation in there. And for me, that's part of that golden generation that I always respect, at how easy it was just to slot in a team where I thought I was, a bit of a nobody, to be honest. Mm. You got the Mark Viduka's, Lucas Neal's, and Tim Cahill's, and you go, wow, this is pretty good. But then you sit down with someone like a Viduka, and you go, geez, this is like talking to my mate on the weekend.
Mm. What was he like as a captain? Because I can't imagine Mark Viduka being the rev-up kind of captain in the dressing room before the game. How did he try and inspire the team?
Yeah, look, I think you got different types of captains, and Mark probably wasn't that typical captain that you get week in, week out, that drives the players, that talks to them individually. I think he led by respect and what he's done in the game. And no one questioned that he's got that armband because, you know what, he's one of our, if not, for me, it's between him and Kuehl, our all-time greatest.
Mm.
That's a level of respect. And the human being that he is, you just wanted to play for him and you listened to him and you respected him and you believed in him. And he wasn't the type of player that will sit down, talk to the group. He didn't need to. He walked on that field and you knew that you were playing for your captain as well as your country and, the 11 people or the 23 people that are part of that squad.
I want to ask you, I want to ask you a question about the 2006 World Cup. Obviously, a great experience, part of all our collective football memory. You were there as the number three goalkeeper. As has been revealed in the years since, there was a bit of tension between the keepers. Not you, but Mark Schwarzer and Zeljko Kalates obviously were vying for that number one spot. And Hiddink was, he was happy for that tension to exist, wasn't he? How did that affect you as the number three? Were you the peacemaker?
I was like the Steve Bradbury of it, hoping that it just all fall apart and I'll just slot myself straight into that middle. But there was tension. There really was. And anyone who knows Spider, he's not going to back down from anything and stir the pot. And he was stirring the pot. And we had a manager in Gus Hiddink that everyone respected. But, it's widely known that he probably didn't have that full belief in either one of them at that World Cup, which was surprising for what they've both achieved. So there was definitely tension and there was, push and shove and I should be playing and all of the above. So I just sat back and, I respect the two goalkeepers for what they did. And when I came in, for me, it was a privilege to be part of that World Cup. That was massive. So I just went along my business and I knew I was going to be the goalkeeper that was going to take a million shots at the end of training and do that. And whatever happens, happens. I respect where I'm at. If I get an opportunity, that would be beyond belief. But on you had two goalkeepers and they were fighting on it, but they held it in well. And Schwartzy is that kind of character that doesn't really want to get involved in that.
But it annoyed him massively. Mark Schwartz is on the record as saying that for someone who is so calm and sometimes a bit of a politician as a footballer, that really got under his skin. And he said on the record that Zelko, was in his mind, spoke out of turn. He said on the record in an interview that you were given two rules when it came to media. Don't speak about the opposition and don't speak about someone who you might be vying for a position with. And he said the first media session, Zelko came out and said, I should be number one, I'm playing for AC Milan.
That's spider to a T.
And that annoyed Schwartzy a lot. He's on the record of saying that.
But that's where I go back to this mentality about goalkeepers. Like, you would not have seen that in that period with Schwartzy. He wouldn't have known that, you know, he's pissed off or, you know, he's angry about it. But, yeah, it would have been hard to have someone as vocal as Spider, it was.
Did that make things tense on the training ground during the World Cup?
It did too, because you knew it was there. They went about their business. Once on the training field, there wasn't any stabs at each other or anything. You did your business. You know, Spider would, you know, talk his business outside of the field and say, I'm number one. But on the field, they worked hard. But you could sort of like feel that because, you know, Spider's obviously has something in the media and you're going at the next training session. Is anything going to happen? What's is someone going to say something? Like, you could feel it, but he just sort of like just went through every session. He just kept on going through. Nothing really exploded.
As brilliant as Gus was, he didn't get that right, did he? I mean, it clearly didn't work.
No. There's not much that he got wrong. That you could say that he probably didn't handle the best way. I think he could have. You know, he is a sort of manager that, like you just said, don't talk about the other players, but he sort of let that go, didn't he? And goalkeeping, obviously, for me, is a very important aspect of that game, and you need belief in those goalkeepers. So you haven't got a choice to get someone else in the last minute. That's what you're dealt with. So I thought he could have probably put a little bit more support. Who's the number one?
Yeah.
All right, believe in you. Go out, do your job. Get the 3 points for the team.
Two more big incidents that could have potentially happened between those two. I know at the time, the Uruguay qualifier 2005, you were involved in that as well, that the Hiddink was allegedly considering bringing Calatz on for the penalty shootout.
Yes.
He was going to. Then Brett Emerton, I think, got an injury, so he couldn't do that. I think he was contemplating the same. You can confirm this, perhaps. He was going to do the same thing in the round of 16 against Italy, before they got the late penalty, thanks to the Lucas Neal, Fabio Grosso challenge. Was Calatz warming up for that shootout as well, as you remember?
Not that one.
No.
I'm a bit suspect on that. I'm not sure if that was because we still had 30 minutes of that extra time. Yeah. So whether that was in his mind, but definitely for the Uruguay, that was, Schwarzer, I know from that one. That's one instance that Schwarzer did. Yeah, make his views known that he wasn't happy.
Schwarzer said
turned
that.
Out all right for Schwarzer. Yeah.
He said that it would have been irretrievable for him. Now that's in the heat of the moment.
He's not
sure if he could have played for the national team again had that happened.
Yeah,
he's on the record of saying that as well.
Yeah,
that might have changed over time. You don't know, but he looks back at it now. He thinks, I don't know if I could have, because it would have just hurt.
And I would
me
have
so
understood
much.
Him. Like, he's done so well and what he's achieved in his game, and you're going, well, how many penalty shootouts have either one of you been in? Does someone really, just because Spider's 2 metres tall, does he really have a handle on a penalty shootout situation? It's as big mentally as it is physically for a goalkeeper. So I understand him playing that whole game, two games, playing fantastic, and you're subbed. You're going, that'd be a big, big shot.
And when he brought Calatz in, obviously, for the Croatia game, it's no disrespect to Spider, it was a great goalkeeper as well, but he made a blunder, didn't he?
He did make a blunder. He did make a blunder, and that sort of sealed his fate, I think, for the next game. That sort of proved that point, but it was a blunder in a game that maybe he himself sort of built his own hype up where he crumbled. But, you know, I'll tell you one thing about that afterwards. If that was me, like, if I make mistakes in big games like that, I take it personally, you know, and I'd trundle off that
You're
field
brood.
And be, you know, like, sorry, guys, and all that. Spider came into that dressing room like he just won the World Cup, like, because we obviously qualified, but you wouldn't have even thought that he made a mistake, you know, like, that just coming, boys, yes, we've done it, this and that. You go, you always got to the game.
Is that a defence mechanism, maybe?
I know, but that's someone
short
that. No, that's one thing Spider would, you know, It would only happen with Spider, I think. So.
And then Schwarzer arguably made a mistake in the Japan game as well earlier. I mean, differing opinions on that. So clearly Goose didn't have them in the right mindset.
That was when he gave Schwarzer the leeway to be the number one. He was very harsh on him with that mistake from like he couldn't understand that 6'4" goalkeeper didn't absolutely just crunch and go through Japanese player that could nudge him off like that.
Just want to ask you a question about your own career. We mentioned that you played for a lot of clubs. You had one season at Melbourne Victory where you were number one, you won the player of the season there, and then Ange Postecoglou came in and decided to dispense with your services. Was that a tough moment in your career?
Massive. There's a lot of tough moments in a football. If we have 20 years, not everything is rosy. There's been a lot of tough ones. But for me, that was because I really enjoyed coming back home and living in Melbourne. I really enjoyed my time there. And it was a great club, great facilities, had a fantastic year. The player's player of the year. And I thought, you know, shoo-in to stay there. That's where I want to stay. You know, bought a house and everything and thinking all's nice and rosy. And my agents were speaking to Postecoglou. Yeah, we'll sit down for a chat. That chat never came around. I got a phone call. This is the one disappointing part for me about that experience was that I got a phone call in the car with my parents who came visited and just told from someone in the club that you're not needed anymore. And I thought, I could have been called in and sat down and I still would have been disappointed, but it was kind of like a little bit of a respect thing. That was a definite blow because at that stage I'm 37, whatever, and you're going, okay, where do I go to now? Who's going to take that chance? But you know what? The same thing happened to me with Wanderers.
Well, I was going to say on Postecoglou, though, because I remember interviewing you in Morocco at the Club World Cup and you were in unbelievable form. You'd led Western Sydney to that Club World Cup, having won the Asian Champions League where you were the hero, and Ange didn't pick you for a Socceroos squad around then. And I remember you unloading verbally.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is it? Why didn't it quite click between you two? It's odd.
I don't know. I haven't had that many dealings with Ange. I doubt it's personal. There's no question about that it's not. Ange has obviously always had his, way of doing things and his own beliefs and what players should be in it. And whenever you're cut and you feel like you should be there and all that, it's going to be disappointing. So if I had a chat with him and he said, look, I don't need you for this and this, you're still upset, but you sort of take it. You go, this is the nature of the beast. This is what the game is. You know, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself, you made a mistake. You know, I think you made a mistake, but it's your decision. So I can't question him on that. But, I don't know. I really don't know. I was in good form and all that. And, I had 5 years in the Socceroos, and that was some of my biggest memories in football. Like, to represent your country, I don't think many people can understand what that truly feels like. So if you're playing in form and you've got that, you think you've got that opportunity, like as footballers, that's what you are. You're so focused and you're so hell-bent that I'm good enough, I should be in there. But that's what drives you to be the best anyway. So, I don't usually let go, but, I was good enough.
You did later on in that tournament as well when you had that there was that deluge game against Cruz Azul.
Yeah, and we had two players sent off.
It was a torrential downball. The game should have been called off. Oh. And I remember there are two football interviews that stand out for me, post-game interviews where players unload. One's Milos Deganek recently at the Asian Cup where he gave away the goal against UAE in the quarterfinals and he blamed himself and all that. And yours in that game where the media manager said, Ante, please calm down. And you went, stuff that. And you just completely let fly at the officials and everything, saying, if this is Real Madrid, they would have called the game off.
I think that was that. Like, that run through the whole Champions League and to win the Champions League and go to a tournament like the Club World Cup, and then that cherry on the cake was Real Madrid.
Yeah.
They were there. And we had everything going for us, and that game was an absolute farce.
Yeah.
You know, and the send-offs were a farce. And, to continue playing was a farce. And that opportunity to play against the world's best, and I remember sitting in the hotel after we got knocked out, and I couldn't watch Cruz Azul playing Real Madrid because I was fuming. That should be us. And Real Madrid put their first team on. You know, could have been playing against the world's best.
Yeah.
And I thought we were so, we're royally screwed, to be honest, and I couldn't let it go.
We could talk about your career for ages. We've got to move on, though. It's been great getting into some detail with it. Quickly, Liverpool, Man United this morning. United did what I think a lot of Liverpool fans thought they might do, which is set up for their game of the season and fire up for an encounter that Liverpool used to do when they were rubbish and United were winning games and take the odd point here and there. And fair play to them, they executed well, but Liverpool just weren't at their best and their first drop points of the season.
Yeah, look, I think we mentioned derbies before, and I think sometimes it sort of gets a little preference to the underdog, because that's their sort of, United haven't been doing well. And if they get this one, that gives them a little bit of credibility for what's been a poor season so far. Mm. So you kind of fire up a little bit more. But, yeah, Liverpool were relatively poor, to be honest. I don't think they had the fluidity that they've had in the first eight, nine games, whatever it is at the moment. But, Man U took it to them. And, they got that goal in the end, which saved their bacon. But, Man U will get probably a lot of more out of that than Liverpool, the disappointment.
Still a six-point lead. I don't think you can complain too much about that from a Liverpool point of view.
But it's down to six. It's a little bit narrower.
No one thought it would keep stretching.
And of all teams, you want 6 points behind. You don't want Man City.
And they've got Liverpool in 3 weeks. So it was always going to be a situation that.
Can I just say a good win for City, because Crystal Palace have been a bogey side for us over the last couple of seasons. Even though we played in that horrible fruit salad strip, we managed to come away with the 3 points, 2-0 win, and playing with two central midfielders as central defenders, Fernandinho and Rodri. Goodness me, the stocks are a little bit thin at the moment in that regard for Pep.
Leicester are flying up to third. Chelsea doing well under Frank Lampard, sitting fourth as well. Spurs, something needs to happen there, it seems, right now.
That's a weird one.
Either he needs to overhaul the squad and get three or four players out and change that dressing room up, or he's got to go. It just seems rotten right now.
Yeah, I can't put my finger on what's really going on.
They seem in a happy camp, don't they?
Yeah, and I'm sort of perplexed. Why?
I think he tried to get players out in the off season and tried to move it on and refresh the squad, and it didn't happen. Mm. And those players are now don't seem to be happy because of that. Yeah. And he's not happy because he wasn't allowed to do it. And there seems to be a breakdown between him and the board, or him and the players, and that dressing room that just doesn't have
the same. And that talk's still there, isn't it? He's been talking about the transfer window in January, that if things keep going, I'll get to go into it. Mm. So how does that affect the run into that transfer window?
I think it all opens things up for Leicester to be a top four team this season.
Yeah.
They're looking really good under Brendan Rodgers. Terrific.
They've got some depth and they're playing lovely football. I thought it would be Leicester, West Ham or Everton. One of them would jump up. Everton had a good win on the weekend, but Leicester seems like the team right now. And the Hammers are also
Can I just give the quote of the weekend?
Yes.
Jose Mourinho on television about Jurgen Klopp at Old Trafford. He doesn't like the menu. He wanted meat, but he got fish. It's very Cantona-esque, that, isn't it, from Jose?
Funny from Jose, because he was not someone who agreed with things all the time himself. So it's a slight bit of hypocrisy there. He didn't mind arcing up when it suited him when he was a manager.
Absolutely. But it's good fodder for us, Jerno.
Exactly right. This has been really good fodder. That's the podcast for today. Ante, thanks so much for coming in. It was great talking about current day
great
football.
Great to see you, Ante.
Delving into the past as well.
Always a pleasure to talk football and with you guys. Fantastic.
Cheers, guys.
FFA Cup on Wednesday night, the final, massive occasion. Adelaide against Melbourne City. Adelaide going for their third FFA Cup, City for their second.
Yeah.
So looking forward to that. And then a big weekend of football all on Fox Sports.
Can I ask one final question,
the Sydney Derby?
One final quick question. Long term, we know Matty Ryan's the number one, and there's a couple behind him at the moment. Who's the long term Australian number one?
Oh, geez. I think that's the one area. Yeah, surprisingly, we're struggling.
Paul Lizzo, maybe?
I don't think he's there yet. That's actually a really tough question, because years ago we had a plethora of ones that will put their hand up for a number one, and I don't think we have that right now. Besides Matt Ryan at the moment, he's head and shoulders the clear number one. Who comes after that?
It's hard to say, because he's probably got 10 years.
Yeah, and he's young, yeah, and he's playing at the highest level. So who's going to take his spot? And who's you're probably now looking more so, who's that next younger generation going to come through when he hangs up? Because of the current crop, I don't think anyone's got enough to take his position.
Interesting.
So who's that next one that's coming through? And that's what we have to look at. But the goalkeeping stocks for me has sort of dropped off over the last few years.
Interesting. Ante, thanks for coming in. Great chat. I'm sure people
enjoyed some
of the stories. Thanks for listening, as you always do. We'll be back next week with another special guest, I'm sure. on the Fox Football Podcast. Adam and friends will be back during the week. Tune in for that. Phil Pryor, thanks so much for putting it all together.